Tiffany shook her head.
I don't think so.
Angela gave Tiffany a suspicious look. Do you? Tiffany stared off at the gaggle of police and onlookers.
Yeah. When I found Barry on the floor, I rushed to help him. His face looked like raw hamburger. That white T-shirt he always wears was soaked red with blood. It had holes burned in it, and he had burns, like from a cigarette. He had a rag stuffed in his mouth. They'd been torturing him. I pulled the rag out so he could breathe.
Was he conscious?
Barely.
Tiffany sniffed back a sob.
I asked him what happened. All he was able to say was, "Those Mexicans." Then he lost consciousness.
Angela felt goosebumps race across the bare flesh of her legs and arms. She knew without a doubt what Mexicans he was talking about.
Did you tell the police?
Tiffany huffed her contempt.
Fuck the police!
Well, who called them?
I did.
Didn't they ask your name? Tiffany gestured toward the simple block building. The beer sign in the window glowed its perpetual invitation.
I didn't use my cell phone. I called from the phone behind the bar. That's where Barry was laying. They asked what was the emergency. I told them that someone robbed Barry's place bar and that Barry was hurt real bad. Before they could ask anything else, I hung up. I stayed with Barry until I heard the sirens, and then I got out before they saw me.
Angela frowned. Why didn't you want to tell the police what you knew? With a finger, Tiffany carefully wiped the lipstick from each corner of her mouth. It was a long moment before she answered.
I never told you about it before, but I was arrested not long ago.
You? For what?
Prostitution.
Tiffany dressed like a slut, but Angela had always thought that was just to get better tips. I didn't know. Tiffany's expression drew down into a scowl.
I don't hook, all right? This off-duty cop, Officer Polinski, a real mean motherfucker, was in here one night. He wanted me to come out to the parking lot and give him a blowjob. I didn't know he was a cop. I told him to fuck off. He came back in his blues later that night and arrested me for solicitation, took me to jail and had me booked, said I had solicited him. My mother had to come down and bail me out.
Tiffany shook her head in anger at the memory. Guys asked Angela to suck their cocks often enough, but so far none of them had been a cop, so she'd never feared getting arrested when she said no.
But that ain't the worst of it, Tiffany said. The prosecutor called me in. He gave me that smug smile like he knows I'm a whore, know what I mean?
Yeah, I know the look.
And then he says to me, he says, if I want, he could help me out of the jam I was in and maybe drop the charges. I said I'd appreciate that because they weren't true.
She looked over at Angela.
It's not good for your health to go accusing cops of shit, know what I mean? So I said it was just an honest misunderstanding.
Angela nodded.
So this prosecutor, he's still got this shit-eating grin on his fat face, says to me that his officer has pretty good taste in cocksuckers. He told me then that he could add on some drug-dealing charges so that I'd spend at least 6 months, maybe even a year, in jail.
Tiffany glared off at the police. Silent tears started rolling down her cheeks again.
I got a kid, you know? A daughter. This fucker says that he could make sure that when I was convicted, the county would take away my kid.
She wiped the tears from under her eyes with the tissue.
She's only three.
Geez, Tiffany. I had no idea. Angela had been taken by the county once when they sent her mother to rehab. It had been a fresh kind of hell, one invented by the legal system. They had Angela in their clutches for 6 months before she was tossed back into the frying pan.
He asked what I'd be willing to do to get the charges dismissed so I could keep my kid. I thought he meant community service or something, so I told him I'd do anything, you know? He says to me, then, that all I had to do was to come around to his place a few times a week for a month or so and give him a blowjob, and if I did it good enough, he'd drop all the charges. He said I'd need to give Polinski his blowjob so that he'd be willing to go along with the charges being dropped.
Angela didn't have to ask if Tiffany agreed to the deal. What was the prosecutor's name? Tiffany made a face.
Assistant District Attorney John Babington.
Why?
You know him?
I know the prick, Angela said under her breath.
Yeah? Sorry to hear that you had a run-in with that motherfucker.
After a time, Angela asked, Did Barry say anything else?
No.
Tiffany shook her head.
All he mumbled when I asked him what happened was, those Mexicans, before he passed out. I hope to God he makes it. Barry's a good guy, you know?
Yeah, I know. As Angela listened to Tiffany's story, she was trying to figure out why in the world the four men who had attacked her would have done this to Barry. Tiffany trembled as she hugged herself.
I gotta pay my rent. I got a kid. What am I going to do?
Well, Angela said, thinking out loud, some of us girls have keys to the place. Why don't we keep the bar open? Barry has bills to pay, too. We don't want him to lose his bar. Most of the girls are like you. They can't afford to be out of work. It would help all of us out, and it would help Barry out until he got better if we all pitched in and kept the place up and running. Tiffany started smiling for the first time.
Yeah, we could do that.
Her eyes widened when she had the spark of an idea.
We could start a ladies' night. Offer them a free drink. That would bring in women, and women bring in lots of men.
Barry never wanted to have a ladies' night, Angela said.
Well, Barry ain't here to say no.
She snapped her fingers.
I could bring in a string of Christmas lights, and we could hang them up behind the bar or something. It would class up the place, make it look fancy. We could even paint the ladies' room, you know? Make it look better so women would want to stay around. Until Barry gets better, we could do some things to make the place more money than it brings in now. I'm sure of it. And if we do it right, bring in the ladies, we'd all make a lot more tips from the men who would come in.
Angela thought about it for a minute. It sounded like it was worth a try. It certainly would help Barry out if the bar pulled in some money for him while he was in the hospital and until he could recover. If he recovered. I think that sounds like a great idea. You'd be able to make more money to help out with your little girl. Tiffany considered a moment.
With just us girls, I think we'd need a man around to watch over things, like a bouncer or something, so there wouldn't be trouble we couldn't handle.
I think you're right. Barry always watched over everything. Him and that baseball bat he keeps behind the bar. But I guess it didn't help him tonight.
Any idea who we can get?
Angela shook her head. I don't know. We'll have to give it some thought. Tiffany looked over.
Hey, wasn't it some Mexicans that almost killed you, too?
Angela stared off into the darkness. As a matter of fact, it was. Tiffany frowned.
But they're in jail, so it couldn't be the same ones.
They're not in jail. The charges were dropped and they were released.
Dropped? Why?
Babington let them go.
Fuck,
Tiffany said under her breath. Angela didn't believe in coincidences. It had to be the same four. She suddenly realized why they had tortured Barry. 40. The city they drove through, like many cities in America, seemed run down, neglected, and devoid of hope. Many of the places where Raphael had grown up were old, but they were old in a different way. They were old in a historic way, with buildings, monuments, and mosques that were many hundreds of years old. Some were thousands of years old. In his land, history lived in all of them. History never died. Everything in these cities looked merely decades old, and already they were unkempt and rotting. The people in America were weak. Their lives were aimless, They did not accept Allah. Soon many would die under the withering light of the sun Raphael and his brothers would unleash on them. Raphael spotted the beige Toyota off to the side of the parking lot of the convenience store. Because the building they owned where they would assemble the bomb was remote and difficult to find, Miguel had suggested they meet at the convenience store, and then he would guide them to the building just outside town. Raphael pulled his used cargo van into the lot and tapped the horn once. The cars that were escorting the van and protecting its cargo were spread out all around them. Some waited out on the street, some were behind, some were out ahead, making sure they would not encounter any problems. A hand extended up in recognition from the front passenger window. The four-door Toyota Camry turned on its headlights and pulled out in front of Raphael to lead the way. As they left the lights of the city behind, the countryside became dark and forbidding. Raphael had never seen so many trees in all his life as he saw driving across the country. They came right up to the road all around. It was claustrophobic. As was typical, Casiel hadn't spoken for hours. He silently watched the American landscape go by out his window.
"So," Raphael said, "what do you think of America so far?"
Casiel continued looking out the passenger window as he spoke.
"I have been to America before."
Raphael briefly glanced over as he turned a corner, following the Toyota onto a different road.
"You have?"
Casiel nodded.
"As a matter of fact, I came to this very city, Milford Falls, several years back. It looks the same."
Raphael was surprised to hear it.
"Why were you here?"
Casiel was still looking out the side window.
"I came here to kill some people."
Raphael glanced over to meet Casiel's gaze.
"You should rejoice, then. You are about to have the chance to be part of killing many more people."
Hassan had told him that Casiel was a killer. In fact, he had been about to be put to death for killing a family in Iran. But Hassan thought that a man like that would be useful for their mission. Raphael didn't agree. Every detail of their mission had been painstakingly planned and every need supplied. He didn't see what Casiel could add to their mission. It felt more like he was babysitting a moody child than having the fellowship of a brother in arms. The Toyota led them through a dark countryside until they entered what appeared to be an industrial area, but it looked long deserted. Raphael saw no cars, no people, no signs of life. The buildings were decaying and looked to have been abandoned for many, many years. Windows were broken out. Many of the walls had spray-painted words or symbols that made no sense. Where Raphael came from, people who did this kind of thing would be put in jail or in work camps or might even be put to death. But America was a land devoid of morality. As they made their way through a maze of crumbling buildings, he saw sprawling areas surrounded by chain-link fencing and barbed wire. The whole place was a maze of ruins. Raphael realized that Miguel was right to suggest leading them in. He would never have been able to navigate the concrete labyrinth of American industrial decay on his own. As they pulled up to the end of a large building with a curved roof and almost no windows, one of their men, waiting outside, jumped up and rolled a big door to the side. He waved the Toyota, Raphael's van, and all the escort of vehicles inside. Because the building was so large, it swallowed all the cars and trucks so that no one going past would have any idea that there was any activity inside. There were only a few battery-powered work lights on, leaving most of the cavernous building dark. One of their men motioned to Raphael where to park to be in position for unloading. The Toyota parked off to the side. When Raphael climbed out of the van, Miguel rushed up to greet him. The smiling man gripped Raphael by the sides of his arms, leaned in, and ceremonially kissed each cheek.
We are so relieved that you have made it here safely, brother, Emilio said. We followed with great interest the glory you brought to us at the border crossing. It was a tremendous strike against the infidels.
Rafael nodded.
It was everything we have planned for all these years. Esteban and Javier brought great glory to themselves and are now with Allah.
A cheer went up for their martyred comrades. Miguel regarded the stranger suspiciously.
Who is this?
Rafael held out a hand.
This is Casiel. Hassan assigned him to come with me. Casiel has special talents that may be useful. He is an expert in a variety of weapons. I have been assured that he is lethal with all of them.
Casiel bowed his head to the men.
You can all introduce yourselves later, Rafael said. For now, I would like to see your work.
Miguel held out a hand in invitation.
I am sure you will be pleased to find everything ready for you. Here, on the floor, as you can see, we have the lead sections prepared.
They looked just like the ones they had practiced making many times back in Iran, under the watchful eyes of their technical trainers. Miguel moved on to a row of shelves.
Once we completed the machining, we moved everything here to be ready for final assembly.
He handed Rafael one of the geometrically shaped pieces of Semtex. Assembled in a sphere around the outside of the lead tamper, they would form the explosive lens that would implode the plutonium pit to critical mass. Rafael noted that they were as well made as those they practiced making many times.
And here are the brass chimney sleeves. As you can see, the connectors for the detonators are already installed and awaiting the attachment of the EBW.
The exploding bridge wire arrived safely by courier?
Yes, of course,
Miguel said.
We laid it into the wiring loom. It is ready now for the final connections.
Rafael caught Miguel's brief sideways glance to Juan, Emilio, and Pedro, who were standing not far off to the side. Rafael leaned in a little.
You did follow my instructions, didn't you? Hassan wanted the courier eliminated. You followed the orders, included with the EBW, and killed the courier?
Well,
Miguel said as he fidgeted with the brass sleeve he was holding.
We certainly did follow your instructions. The courier was a woman who works for herself,
he gestured offhandedly.
We hanged her.
You hanged her.
Rafael looked to the sheepish faces of the other three.
But you didn't say if you killed her, as instructed. We beat her so she was hardly conscious, and then we put a rope around her neck. We hanged her up by her neck,
Miguel gestured off to his right,
over at the other place where we did the machining. We had things we needed to do over here, so we left her hanging there by her neck to choke to death.
Did that kill her? Did you see her dead?
Actually, no.
Miguel turned his palms up.
Who could know that a person could escape from that? It was impossible for anyone to escape from that rope. We were sure of it.
So then, this woman, you say, could not possibly escape. Escaped.
Miguel shrugged self-consciously.
There was no way for us to know.
Rafael took a settling breath as he gritted his teeth while looking around at the four men.
Well, yes, there is a way to know. You stay there until she is dead, or, better yet, you cut off her head.
We were working hard on finishing the job so that we would be ready for you, Rafael. That was what was most important. The woman went to the police, but they let us go because they believe we are Mexican immigrants. The police are not interested in charging us with a crime. We know that we must fix this, so we went to the bar where this American whore works to find out where she lives.
At first, the man who owns the bar wouldn't tell us. In the end, he told us how to get to her house.
And did you kill him so he couldn't tell the authorities you were the same men who tried to kill his courier?
Miguel nodded furiously.
Yes, Rafael, of course we killed him. I'm pretty sure he was dead when we left him.
Pretty sure. Not sure, just pretty sure.
He was not breathing.
And I thought Jose was the stupid one,
Rafael said under his breath as he shook his head in frustration.
So who is this woman that you hanged?
Her name is Angela Constantine. She is an American whore.
He flashed a brief smile.
We used her as a wife to us before we hanged her.
Rafael noticed that Casiel had come closer. The man's hands had fisted at his sides.
You say you know where she lives? Rafael asked.
Miguel nodded furiously before repeating the directions to her house. Rafael grabbed the man's shirt and yanked him close.
I want you, Juan, Emilio, and Pedro to go to her house, right now, and finish the job, as you were instructed. Do you understand?
Miguel nodded again, afraid to speak. Rafael looked at the other three, standing self-consciously together.
Do you all have knives?
They all nodded.
Shouldn't we take some guns?
Pedro asked.
Why? So that if you're stopped by the police, you can be arrested for carrying AK-47s? So that you can be interrogated about being heavily armed illegal aliens? So that the authorities can discover our operation and put a stop to our decades of planning? They let you go before because they thought you were simply undocumented Mexican immigrants. They won't let you go if you are caught with guns.
Sorry, Rafael,
Miguel rushed to say.
No guns. We can do what is needed with our knives.
I think I should go with them,
Casiel said in his gravelly voice. Rafael thought the man looked a little too eager to go back to his personal fetish.
No. This is not your responsibility. Miguel and his men should be the ones to take care of it.
Miguel nodded again.
We will, Rafael, I swear.
Rafael swept a finger back and forth, pointing at the four men.
I want you to cut off her head and bring it to me. Do you think you can do that correctly this time? Do you think that you four strong men with knives can handle this one woman who escaped from you already once before?
Yes, Rafael,
they said as one.
We handled her easily before,
Miguel added.
She's not big enough to cause us any problem.
He dismissed her importance with a casual flick of his hand.
Our only mistake was being too eager to get on with our work and not staying to see that she was dead. That's all.
We will take care of it.
Then get going and finish it before she can cause any trouble.
The four men all scrambled to get into the Toyota.
All right,
Rafael said to all the other men standing around him as the door rolled to the side and the Toyota drove off into the night.
You all know what to do. You all know what this means for us, for our cause. Our computer team in Russia successfully launched the cyber attacks so that we might be able to succeed with our part of the mission. American intelligence agencies have blamed the Russians for the cyber attack. America is angry and demanding retaliation. Our comrades running those servers in Russia are standing by for the second phase. Just before detonation, they will launch a second wave of cyber attacks. Those cyber attacks will hopefully cause U.S. defense agencies to assume that the nuclear attack that we launch was the second phase of a Russian attack on America. This will hopefully result in the U.S. launching a nuclear strike at Russia. Once those missiles are in the air, Russia will counterattack with their own missiles.
This all means that within a matter of minutes, World War III may be underway. The great Satan will be destroyed. But even if such a nuclear war does not develop, America will never recover from the blow we strike. Hundreds of thousands of infidels will die. Vast territory will be uninhabitable. The electromagnetic pulse will take out much of America's infrastructure. The U.S. will be thrown into chaos. Many millions more will starve to death as they shiver in the darkness we have brought upon them. Our strike, carried about by those of us in this room, will be a turning point for the Islamic world. We now know how to get nuclear material into America. Others will follow the path we have laid out. Israel will be next. With what we do, the final destruction of the great Satan will be underway, and then Israel will at long last be wiped from existence. They cannot destroy the entire Islamic world. We are used to surviving in darkness. They are not. Once this new nuclear phase of our war against the West is underway, nothing will stop it. We will change the balance of power. Islam will become the new ruling superpower.
The men all around, listening to his speech, thrust a fist into the air as they let out cheers. These men had devoted their entire lives to this mission and this cause. They had trained in every field necessary to make plutonium bombs, both in Iran and Pakistan, and a few of them in North Korea. They had worked their whole lives at being able to pass as Mexican immigrants who so easily moved into and throughout American society. No one would suspect the darkness they were about to bring to America.
Now, put on your protective clothing,
he gestured to his second in command.
Alejandro, see to the material that is to go into the cargo van. You will oversee this crew here. I will take the van to the second location.
Splitting up the material increased the chances they would remain undiscovered until it was too late. He looked to his second in command.
You have the entire place wired with explosives, just in case?
Alejandro bowed his head.
Yes, Commander. Casiel, you will come with me and my half of the team. The rest of you know what to do. If we work hard, we should be able to complete the assembly and be ready in a few days. The countdown can then begin. When that hour is upon us, we will bring the great Satan to its knees.
41. As Angela dropped the cable in front of her driveway, a car pulled off the road and across the drive at an angle. Gravel crunched under the tires as it rolled to a slow stop. It was hard to see in the dark with the headlights blinding her, but she thought it looked like a government-issue sedan. She was reluctant to draw the gun she had in its holster at the small of her back, because it might only be someone who was lost. More than that, though, it would be a big mistake to draw a weapon if it turned out to be an unmarked police car. But out here on this lonely stretch of road, it could easily be trouble of one kind or another. So as she walked around to the driver's door, when she heard the window rolling down, she was ready to draw the weapon at the first sign of trouble. Angela leaned down a little, but stood back to give herself room to draw her weapon if she needed to, and enough room that the person in the car couldn't grab it. The door popped open just enough for the interior light to come on and showed John Babington grinning up at her. His suit jacket and tie were lying over the passenger seat. His shirt collar was unbuttoned.
"I need to have a talk with you," he said.
Angela was sick about what had happened to Barry. If Babington had prosecuted the men who had tried to kill her, they would have been in jail and Barry would be fine. It was this man's fault that Barry was in the hospital, near death. About what?
About the serious charges against you.
This was new. What charges?
Well,
he drawled.
That's what I'm here to talk to you about. Took me some digging to find out where you live. Why don't I follow you up to your house and we can talk about it?
He winked at her.
I'm sure we can work it out.
This was not the way legitimate prosecutors conducted business, but Angela knew better than to flat out tell him to fuck off, even though that was what she really wanted to do. John Babington was about the last thing in the world she wanted to deal with at the moment. She knew, though, that sometimes you just had to take opportunities when they presented themselves. She smiled down at him. Sure, okay. Angela got back in her truck and drove up the road to her house. Babington followed and pulled around to park next to her. As she unlocked the front door, he stood uncomfortably close behind her. She turned on the living room light as she walked into the house. She was still wearing the low-rise cut-off shorts for her job tending bar. She knew he was watching her ass. There was little doubt about what he had on his mind. She expected that he wanted to make her a similar offer to the one he'd made Tiffany. Angela turned around and tried to sound apprehensive. This time, she was not in his office in a building full of police and security. This time, he was on her ground, and he had no idea who he was dealing with.
So, what did you want to talk to me about?
You don't want to go to jail, do you?
No, of course not, she said, deliberately elevating the concern in her voice. Can you keep that from happening?
He made a face to indicate maybe. He ran a finger up and down the side of her arm.
You rub my back, I rub yours, so to speak. Know what I mean?
No, she said, playing dumb so that he would spell it out.
He finally dropped the pretense and reached down to put his hand on her crotch. He felt confident because there was no one to see him doing it. Angela didn't move. He reached around with his other hand and grabbed her ass so that she was sandwiched between his fat mitts.
Does this help you get the picture?
He asked.
Are you making me the same kind of offer you made to Tiffany?
He grunted his displeasure.
I'm going to have to teach that little cocksucker to keep her mouth shut, at least when she's not with me.
You know, Angela said as he fondled her ass, your cell phone can be tracked.
Not saying that I would, but if I were to report that you came here to proposition me under threat, the state police could trace your phone's locations and see that you were here tonight. That's why I left my cell phone at work, he said with a smirk.
He tilted his head as if to say he was one step ahead of her and she was outsmarted. She gave him a coy look from under her brow.
I guess, then, that I'm kind of in a spot.
Babington arched an eyebrow as he wormed two fingers under the crotch of her shorts.
Yes, you are, little lady. Now, I'd hate to have to see you sent to jail. So maybe we can work something out to clear up these pending drug and weapons charges?
Angela pushed his hand away from her crotch.
I can't think with you doing that.
What's to think about? He asked. A little trailer park whore like you screws different guys all the time. None of them can keep you out of jail, but I can.
You swear that if I agree you would make sure there are no charges? You swear that will be the end of it? He shrugged.
I come over for a visit from time to time. You take care of me, and I will keep charges from popping up.
You mean this is something ongoing? I'm always going to be under threat of going to jail?
He rolled his eyes back as he smelled the fingers he'd had inside her shorts.
I don't think you have anything to worry about.
You're saying I have to give you sex or you will bring me up on false charges?
His look darkened.
Look, I'm not playing games here. I could easily put you in a great deal of legal jeopardy. It will cost you everything you have and then some to fight it. You will still end up in jail in the end and have a mountain of debt as well.
I can keep that from happening. I'm getting tired of the questions. I suggest you agree before I change my mind.
Angela reached down and grabbed his erection through his dress pants. She pressed herself up against him. If you would handle my legal problem, then I think I could handle your problem. His grin widened.
Now you're talking. We start tonight. Right now.
All right. Angela tilted her head. I like to get all crazy with guys down in the basement. I have a special room set up. She squeezed his erection as she smiled up at him. Know what I mean? The thought clearly excited him.
Lead the way.
Angela looked back over her shoulder and smiled as she unlocked the basement door while he felt her up from behind. She flicked on the light and skipped down the stairs to get away from his hand. He wasted no time in following her. At the bottom, he looked around, trying to figure out what kind of sex room she had set up. Angela flashed him a flirtatious smile. Why don't you have a seat, Mr. Babington, and I'll handle everything. He flopped down onto the metal chair, his head still swiveling around. Angela swung a leg over him to straddle him as she sat on his lap, facing him. Without saying anything, she unbuckled his belt and unzipped his pants. That seemed to reassure him and get his mind back on track. She rested her arms on his shoulders, locking her fingers behind his head so that her face was mere inches from his. This kind of what you had in mind? He was sinking into a trance of desire.
Uh-huh.
You know, she said in an intimate whisper, I've found that justice is often an illusion. He grunted.
Indeed it is.
In fact, I've found that the law has little to do with justice, that laws are merely a way for some people to have power over others, and that if you want justice, sometimes you have to make it happen yourself. Know what I mean? He frowned, trying to figure out where she was going with this.
I'm an officer of the court. I represent the law.
Uh-huh, she said. That's what I'm talking about.
Get on with it, he said, his impatience showing.
Oh, don't worry. You're going to get fucked real good.
Hurry up and get on with it, then.
Angela kissed his cheek. As you wish, she whispered in his ear. His erection throbbed against her. Angela got up off his lap and drew her gun from her grandfather's holster at the small of her back and pointed it right between his eyes. She stepped back far enough so that he couldn't reach up and try to grab it. You're right about one thing. You are an officer of the court. You are supposed to represent the law, but you instead represent what most people in authority have. Power for themselves.
What is your problem, woman?
My problem? Well, let's see. I was beaten, raped, hung by a rope around my neck, and left to choke to death. You let the men who did that go free for your own personal political gain and the gain of the system and politicians you represent. Those criminals went on to beat my friend and boss nearly to death. He may not live the night. You, Mr. Babington, made all that possible. You were an accessory to both crimes. Clearly not intimidated by her gun, he zipped up his pants.
Put that gun down or I'll see to it you go to jail for the rest of your life for pointing a firearm at an officer of the court.
Then I guess, if I'm going to serve the time, I might as well do the crime.
I followed the law with those undocumented aliens. The people of this state want them protected. That's what I did, the people's bidding.
What you did, Mr. Babington, was side with killers rather than their victims. He stood in a huff.
I don't know what kind of game you're playing, young lady, but I'm leaving. You're a fool to think you could get away with this. People would miss me and come looking. You harm me and you will go to jail for attempted murder.
She tilted her head. How do you suppose anyone is going to know where to find you?
You left your phone in your office so that no one would know you were going off to blackmail yet another innocent woman. How many times have you done this? How many women, Mr. Babington? He scowled defiantly as he gestured dismissively.
You're only the second. You and Tiffany, that's all.
Why is it I don't believe you,
I don't care if you believe me or not. I'm leaving. Expect the police to be here within the hour.
Move either foot, and I'll pull the trigger. She could see in his eyes that he was trying to decide if he believed her, and if he dared to try to leave. His gaze went from the gun to the tattoo across her throat. When he saw the words Dark Angel, his confidence faltered. You let those four men go, she told him.
Those men are killers. This isn't only about me. It's about all the other victims you condemn to suffer, like Barry, tonight. How many people have been brutalized or even murdered because you let killers go, or you let them plea bargain, or you lowered the charges as a favor to their attorney? How many monsters have you let go back on the street to kill again?
I only follow the law.
The laws you represent are as corrupt as you are.
All right. You win, he said as he held up his hands as if to ward her off. I'll file charges of attempted murder against those four men. I'll have them prosecuted. I'll see to it that they go to jail for a good long time. How about that? Do we have a deal?
Is that how the law works, Mr. Babington?
That the way it's done? You only enforce it when you're afraid for your life? Not when the victims of violence are afraid for theirs.
Angela had gone to sleep many a night having fantasies about torturing this man to death. It would be easy enough, and he would certainly deserve what she could do to him. But she was worried for Barry, and she just wasn't in the mood. This man sickened her. The system he represented sickened her. She was sick of looking at him, sick of listening to him. While keeping the gun on him, she lifted open the hatch. Angela gestured with her gun. Kneel over here. He frowned.
Why?
Because I said so, that's why. He reluctantly knelt, thinking it might somehow get him out of this. He peered down into the darkness below.
Take everything out of your pockets and toss it to the side.
Please, he said, as he followed her instructions with trembling hands. There was no longer any trace of arrogance in his voice.
I've learned my lesson, I swear. Let me go and I will just forget this whole ugly incident. I'll have those four men arrested and I will charge them with attempted murder like you want. Just let me go.
Angela didn't answer. She walked around behind him and without further ceremony fired a bullet into the back of his skull. A .22 could easily penetrate the thick bone of the skull if fired at a direct angle. Angela's fired at a direct angle. The sound of the shot echoed around the small basement, making her ears ring. John Babington tumbled forward into the hellhole. Angela leaned over, watching his lifeless body descend into the darkness. Karma is a bitch. 42. After John Babington had vanished into the darkness of the hellhole, Angela tossed the gun down after him. She watched it fall, glanced twice off the granite walls on the way down, and finally fade away into the darkness until she could no longer see it. She had learned long ago not to bother waiting to hear things hit bottom. Once she had used a gun to kill someone, that gun became forever tainted with the potential for all kinds of trouble. There was forensic evidence she could only begin to imagine. Blood spatter, serial numbers, as well as distinctive marks left by the magazine, the firing pin, and gun barrel rifling. Once she had used a gun on someone, that gun would never be used again. It always went down the abyss along with the killer. Owen was the only man so far that had not ended up in the hellhole. Of course, the knife she had used to kill him had, along with everything she'd been wearing that could have had any blood evidence on it. Angela could easily have enticed Owen to her house and spent several days initiating him into hell.
But it had been more important to her that Carrie's remains be found so that her family would have closure than it was for Owen to be sent down the hellhole. She hoped that he was in hell, the real one, for the rest of eternity. Angela removed her boots, with her knife and sheath inside the lining, and tossed them down into the hellhole. Like the gun, they could potentially have a wealth of forensic evidence on them. After her boots, she removed her shorts, underwear, and her top and threw them in as well. Even if they never found John Babington's body, a bullet penetrating the skull created internal pressure that often blew blood droplets as well as tiny specks of brain matter and hair back away from the hole. It was inevitable that some of that, even minuscule amounts, would end up on her clothes. He'd had his hand in her pants. They could probably find skin cells from his fingers on her thong. If any tiny speck were to be found on her clothes, the police forensic department could test DNA from his relatives and tie it to Babington. Even without a body, they could probably still convict her of killing him on circumstantial evidence alone. Truly evil men often got away with their crimes because of legal technicalities, or things like Babington dropping the charges for political reasons. Even when politics weren't involved, the victims were routinely ignored as unimportant, while thugs like Bosca were granted favors and leniency. Time after time, they were let go for any reason someone could come up with. Rap sheets of violent crimes grew to multiple pages with nothing done to stop, much less punish, the violent criminal. Babington was part of that whole corrupt system. It took something like a minivan to finally end the injustice. But Angela knew that if it was her, they would go to the ends of the earth to make sure she spent the rest of her life in prison. They couldn't have people killing prosecutors, no matter how much they might deserve it. That's the way government officials were, protect their own at all costs. So rather than try to outguess what forensic scientists might be able to find on her shorts or underwear or top or boots or gun or knife, everything she had on when she executed Babington went down the hellhole along with his body. Her best protection was to make sure there was never any evidence to be found. She sometimes wondered if an archaeologist tens of thousands of years in the future would discover the hellhole and all the remains of predators at the bottom. She could only wonder at what theory they would come up with about what it all meant. Angela knelt and went through everything Babington had emptied out of his pockets. She tossed the change down the hole. He had nearly $500 in his wallet. She pulled the cash out. She couldn't see the point in throwing away cash. She looked through the photos. There was a picture of a boat and a photo of a middle-aged woman, presumably his wife. "I just did you a big favor, lady." Angela tossed the wallet down the hellhole. She threw his whole four-leaf clover keyring full of keys down into the darkness. His luck at getting away with the things he did had run out. She stuck her little finger through the key ring with his car keys and remote and set them up on the counter. After she had thrown everything of no use or potentially incriminating down the abyss, she took the garden hose off the wall and thoroughly washed down the floor to get rid of any trace of blood. The water was freezing cold on her bare feet. She promised herself that after she was finished, she would take a hot shower. She also needed the shower to make sure that any speck of blood or brain tissue was washed out of her hair. After winding the hose back up on the reel at the end of the basement, she took a new pair of boots out of the lower cabinet where she kept a dozen pair. She'd used two pair between Owen and then Babington. She made a mental note to order some more. She pulled out a new knife in its new sheath and slipped it into the pocket she had already created between the lining and the leather of the right boot. Once she had new boots prepared, she took a new Walther P-22 out of its box. She tossed the box, with the serial number and the shell inside from the manufacturer's test firing, down the hellhole. She loaded one new magazine with 10 rounds, the second with 9.
They were supposed to hold 10 rounds, but she had learned over years of practice that the magazines didn't always feed reliably with 10 rounds. If she was just target practicing, she might load 10 rounds. It gave her practice at clearing random jams. But when her life depended on the reliability of the gun and magazines she carried, she loaded those spare magazines with 9 rounds. She shoved a magazine loaded with 10 rounds into the gun and cycled the slide to chamber a round, leaving 9 in the magazine. Having 1 chambered and 9 in the magazine gave her 10 rounds the first time around, and 9 thereafter if she needed to reload with a fresh magazine to keep firing. So far, with the murderers she had killed, she'd never needed a second magazine, but she always carried extras just in case. Her grandfather always told her that you could never have too much ammo. Naked, holding new boots loaded with a new knife under her left arm, her holster and a few full magazines in her left hand, and her gun in her right hand with her finger along the side of the slide, she went upstairs to take a shower. As she clicked off the basement light and then the living room light switches with the back of her hand, she heard a car drive up. Angela froze. No one ever drove up uninvited past all the no trespassing signs. She remembered that she had left the cable down after Babington had driven in, so it was always possible that it wasn't trouble arriving at her door. It could be some innocent visitor looking for directions. Angela didn't think she could be that lucky. She dumped everything she was carrying, except her gun, on the couch. The hall light was still on, but otherwise the place was dark. She peeked out the door. The beige, 4-door Toyota Camry that she knew all too well was just coming to a stop. Angela held the gun behind her back and stepped out onto the porch, naked. 43. All 4 car doors popped open. The 2 men on the passenger side stepped out first. In the moonlight, she could see that it was Juan and Pedro. Angela, gun in hand, was already in a near trance, the same as when she practiced with her grandfather's target. She had put thousands of rounds into that steel triangle. Tens of thousands of rounds. Hundreds of thousands of rounds. That triangle haunted her dreams. An ear-to-ear grin grew on Pedro's face.
Ah, I see the American whore is naked and eager to...
She put a round through the center of his face, stopping him cold. The bullet entered through the soft area of that triangle formed by the points between the 2 eyes and tip of the nose, the triangle her grandfather had told her about when she was younger and had her practice hitting. The bullet ricocheted around inside Pedro's skull, turning his brain to pulp and instantly ceasing all neurological function. He dropped where he stood before he had been able to complete the sentence. The way he went down, it looked as if his bones had dissolved. Even as Pedro was still falling, Juan pulled a knife and screamed some sort of battle cry in Spanish that she didn't understand. He charged for the porch. Angela was in no hurry. Her aim had locked onto him. He was that target, wobbling, moving, swaying. Angela shot him between the eyes. He fell dead at her feet. Even as the sounds of the 2 shots were still ringing through the night air and the 2 men were hitting the ground, the other 2 men realized they were in trouble and slammed their doors shut. The driver threw it into gear and matted the gas pedal. Wheels spinning, the car reeled around, throwing up a cloud of dust as it raced back down the driveway and into the darkness. Angela didn't shoot at the escaping car. She didn't think a .22 bullet would penetrate the metal of the car reliably enough to kill the driver. A shot through glass at an angle would deflect a bullet. She doubted that the small caliber slug would blow out a spinning tire. Shooting at the car would be little more than random shots in the dark. She didn't like low-probability shots. Besides, she didn't want the shot to be luck. She wanted to look into their eyes when they died. She wanted her face to be the last thing they saw, as they knew they were an instant away from death. Angela's immediate urge was to go after the 2 men, but she was naked.
By the time she threw on some clothes and grabbed the keys to her truck, she knew they would be long gone and she would be unlikely to find them. It would be a series of choices, left or right, and in the end, they would probably be gone. She would find them, and when she did, she would kill them. Just as she had promised that night in that filthy room on the greasy moving pad, they were not going to get away. They had come back to kill her. They were not going to give up. Neither was she. The most important issue at the moment was the two dead guys in her front yard, and the car of the now officially missing Assistant District Attorney John Babington sitting in front of her house. She believed that she knew generally where she could find the other two men. She thought they were up to something in the old industrial area, so they weren't likely to leave town. They weren't going anywhere for now. She had been out to the deserted industrial area many times looking for them, so far with no luck. But they were still out there somewhere. She knew they were. The fact that they had just shown up at her door to finish the job they had started that night proved it. She would find them, sooner or later, and if they showed up at her house again, all the better. Angela squatted down beside the two dead men. Her address was listed everywhere as a box at Mike's mail service. The address of her house was not listed anywhere or easy to find. They had tortured Barry until he told them where she lived. She didn't blame him for talking. In fact, she wished he had told them what they wanted to know before he had been so badly hurt. Anyone was going to talk under torture. Holding out during prolonged torture wasn't going to accomplish anything, because they would give it up in the end anyway. She knew that well enough. Angela found a knife on Pedro. It was inside a sheath tucked down in his pants. It was a serious combat knife. It was big enough to decapitate someone. Other than that, he didn't have so much as pocket change. No ID, no keys, no nothing. The only thing in his pockets was some lint. Juan's knife was still in his fist where he had fallen on the steps. It was the same kind of combat knife as Pedro's. His fist was still clenched around the handle from that instant when his brain function ceased. A person who died that fast couldn't even unclench their fist. They couldn't even pull the trigger if they had a gun in their hand. He didn't have anything in his pockets either. The only way she knew the men's names was because they had used them when they had been raping and beating her. They had not expected her to leave that abandoned building alive. Neither one looked so smug now. Since they had both died instantly when the bullets had shut down their brain function, each man's eyes were open, staring, in death, looking up at her. She smiled back at them. Angela knew that moving dead men was damn near impossible, and yet she couldn't leave them both sprawled in front of her house. She had to do something. She quickly went back inside and retrieved a new plastic shower curtain. She managed to roll Juan onto it, and then she was able to pull him the rest of the way up the steps. Once she got him inside, it was relatively easy to drag him, rolled up in the plastic shower curtain, across the floor to the basement door. There, she rolled him off the shower curtain and let him tumble down the steps. She used the same plastic shower curtain to drag Pedro to the basement doorway and dump him down the steps as well. She flicked on the light again and went down to find Pedro's lifeless corpse sprawled atop Juan. Fortunately, neither man was big. She opened the hatch, then grabbed Pedro's wrist to drag his body close. Once she had him to the hatch, she rolled him into the hellhole. She did the same with Juan. There was a little blood on the shower curtain, but like anything else with evidence on it, it had to go. Rather than let it billow out on the way down and possibly get hung up on something, she folded it up to make a relatively heavy, compact bundle and then threw it in after the men. "Two down, two to go," she said under her breath as she tossed the second gun that day into the hole. She closed the hatch. Using a .22 kept the bullets contained within the skulls. That meant a minimal amount of blood.
Lots of guys thought big guns were best, but a .357 would blow out the back of the skull and spray blood, bone, and brain matter all over the place. It made a huge mess that left evidence everywhere, and, importantly, the victim was no deader